This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, little shift in gears here. I'm Mike O'Neill here, not with Mike Russell, but with ace reporter Holiday Moore. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks, Mike, for inviting me.
Well, we want to talk about the Middle East, where I've spent the last month.
Yeah, where have you been? You've been out of the house for a while.
That Arizona history, the little secret of audio tape is that for the last month we did Arizona history because I was out of the country and visiting Greece and Turkey.
And my first question to you is, what? Why are you visiting probably one of the most chaotic places in the world right now? Is it safe to be there?
The parts I were in felt actually very safe. But that is also, the turmoil is what made it interesting. And, you know, I'm a political junkie. And all of what was going on in there. And this is really at the, I mean, if you, this is not only about current day, but also goes back 2,000 years. I mean, when you read history, you start with the Greeks. And when you go to Turkey, you discover that, first of all, a lot of their influence are Greek. Then they're Roman. There are more Roman ruins there than there are in Rome, by far. Architecture, philosophy, science, democracy, you know, not much.
And before you jump off into that, because I know you're excited to tell us what you learned, being the scholar that you are, my first question to you is, how on earth was traveling there, with all of the Syrian refugees that are pouring into Turkey, you first went to where?
I went to Greece first, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was interesting. And one of my takeaways, but I'll get into that a little bit more later, but Greece, we think of as Western democracy, mm-hmm. a little more hybrid. But we'll talk about that in a future segment. But if you want to understand Turkey, there's one guy that I want to set up as the whole thing. His name is Ataturk. And in 1923, the Ottoman Empire is disintegrating, and he takes over as president of Turkey. And absolutely everything you see in the country right now is a byproduct of what he did. He forged a massive political compromise and set up a secular Muslim state. The country is 98-99% Muslim, but discreetly secular. And when you see that, I'm going to tell you what that political compromise looks like. For example, you walk around the streets and most of the people are Western dressed, okay? And then the difference in the dress you see is primarily in women. You do see everything from full burqa with little eye slits and nothing more. You've seen a woman walking around in a burqa carrying a cell phone.
You know, so you have this kind of a mix where the Middle East is meeting Western European influence.
And, you know, that's what it's been like for thousands of years, because the ethnic composition of Turkey, it's Greek, it's Turk. I mean, even Turks, first of all, it's Greek and then it's Roman. And then there's other sort of groups. And, you know, there's a country in Asia called Turkmenistan. That's where the Turks came from. But they didn't come till about 1,000 years ago. They're the relative newcomers. And that's sort of across the Caspian Sea to the east. And so if you were to take a genealogical breakdown of the people in that country, they're probably the most mixed on earth. So anyway, I want to tell you what, on a day by day basis, this political compromise looks like. So you have the religious people, mostly in the rural areas, and the religious component is a powerful political force in the country. And Ataturk basically stepped on them pretty hard. And he said, well, no, we are a secular country, and we're gonna look Western, okay?
He's coming from an educational background, too, which at that time was not necessarily regarded very highly there.
Do you remember what the fez looked like, the hat?
Mm-hmm.
He outlawed it. Okay. That was an attempt, and this looked kind of weird. It was uniquely Turkish, and he outlawed it as a way. There were factories that the building still exists. It used to be fez factories.
Why would you outlaw a hat?
Because it looks Eastern, looks Turkish. He's trying to westernize the country. So that's one of the things he did. The other thing, the compromise you have with the religious influence is very strong. The mosques in the latter part of the 20th century put loudspeakers on top of all the spires, and they broadcast prayers five times a day. Let me paint you a picture of that. And I've taken some videos of that capture the sound. But you got this going on all over town. They broadcast multiple mosques. Some places you can hear it coming from different mosques. You look around, however, and hardly anybody's paying attention. Particularly one night I remember when we were at a bar and they're playing heavy rock music on the one hand, and then the sound starts coming out of the mosque because it's the fifth prayer of the evening. And you have this point counterpoint of Western rock music and the religious chanting coming out of the
literally
mosque.
East meets West.
Absolutely. And it was just this very, very striking, contrast between the two. As I said, you see women, handfuls in full burqas, to ranging to a more modified thing with the face open, and then to the scarves. If you go into the mosques, which, by the way, were very welcoming places, they take on visitors.
Did you ever at any time feel unsafe while you were there?
Not at all. Not
really?
At all.
Yeah. You're being protected. Who were you with?
You know, I think a tour group that is very much integrated into the community. I also tell you, I didn't go to southeastern Turkey. That is dicey. That's a whole other world. I'm in Istanbul and a number of places on the western coast and central part of the country that, you know, I'm not talking about going to the Syrian border. I'm not crazy. I was after interesting but not dangerous. And at no point did I felt a cultural stretch, which was fun. But at no point did you had no, other than you did see a few people walking around who claimed to be Syrian refugees. I remember one case, family with a baby stroller and a sign asking for help.
Oh, really? You know? So, but did you doubt that they were? I would assume that you would see tons of people, with 4 million people trying to find their way through anywhere but Syria right now in and around that region.
Most of them are in refugee camps. And a lot of them are trying to break out of there. One of the things you hear about people taking a boat to Lesbos. Lesbos is an island, a Greek island, but it turns out that it's right next to the Turkish coast. And I got close enough to that I could have swam it.
How far is that?
It's like 15 miles or so. It's right off the coast. So, but the difference is when you cross from Turkey into Lesbos, Greece, you're part of the EU. Once you're in the EU, you're pretty much home free to go where you want.
And that's still not easy to do, as
No.
we're seeing in current news
Absolutely.
Right now. Well, we're talking with Mike about his trip to the Middle East, and we're going to talk up next about the history and why it matters to you right there in Turkey and Atatürk. Atatürk is a very complex man, and to be hailed and in other ways to be absolutely detested in that region. We're going to talk about that coming up next, right?
Yep. You want to understand Turkey, you got to understand Atatürk.
That's coming up on The Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
And we're back, and Mike's back, and I'm Holiday Moore. I'm filling in for Mike Russell right now, who's gone fishing.
That's what he usually says.
We're just talking in the first segment about your trip. You were gone for a full month to Turkey, Greece, and that area. My first question was, why Turkey? Why Greece at this time while we're going through such chaos?
Well, that's good reason to my mind to be there. I mean, these things fascinate me. One of the things I got to tell you that absolutely struck me is, I think as Americans, we are sort of woefully unaware of the perspectives of the rest of the world. I think that comes out of the fact that we got this big ocean on both sides of us, and we think that the rest of the world doesn't affect us. We were talking before going in here, you were in Belgium, and talking about how you just have other countries' histories thrust on you if you live in Europe.
Yeah, it was interesting because I was visiting an old roommate of mine, and we were out. The thing to do there is, much like New York City, you end up going out to dinner at 8 o'clock at night, and then you're up until 2 a.m. in the morning sitting around at a pub. And much of the conversation there is about politics. And it's amazing how much they know about American culture and politics, and how little it seems we understood what they were doing. My husband and I.
Yeah.
And so I felt enlightened, but I was seeing that there was a pervasive discussion about why it is so important for them to understand what's going on in those Middle Eastern countries.
Well, let me give an example. And it's probably the biggest thing in our foreign policy now. How enmeshed are we getting in Syria? And at the beginning on this, the government sort of came out, the Obama administration said, you know, basically we want Assad out. Now, Assad is not a nice guy. He's a thug. And he is a member of a sect called the Alawites. They comprise 17% of Syria. So he's a minority government, and it's kind of a very tight little clan. The Alawites stick together, and they are surrounded basically by Sunnis. But they've ruled the country. Now, of late, we become horrified by ISIS. The beheadings are gruesome, and this stuff is just sickening. And then we ask the question, and this gets back to the point of how we don't understand what's other countries' perspective. ISIS has, at best, they estimate 25,000 soldiers. Let me contrast this. Turkey, right next door, has 1 million men under arms. Okay. And if you add together the other countries that are in the neighborhood, it's about 5 million. So the neighbors of Syria have roughly 5 million men under arms, and they can't handle, or from our perspective, they can't handle ISIS. And you say, why? And I think the answer is that it's not their priority. If you want to take
Turkey. Why wouldn't it be their priority?
Well, here's an example of Middle Eastern politics. One of the enemies of ISIS, there are a number of factions within Syria, but one of the key players in this is the Kurds. The Kurds are a distinct ethnic group, and they sort of got cheated out of a country when they drew the maps of the Middle East after World War I. There's a contiguous plot of land, but it includes parts of Iraq, parts of Syria, and here's the tricky part, parts of Turkey. And Turkey doesn't want to give up that part of their country just because it's Kurdish. And there's a group within Turkey called the PKK, who the Turkish government regards as terrorists.
Because they, is that necessarily that they are terrorists, or is it that they disagree with the current Western theologies?
Well, I think, or, you know, theories, so, yeah, they rather. Fight. They fight. You know, so, you know, are they, that's a matter of definition. You know, I mean, if we lost the Revolutionary War, George Washington would have been a terrorist. You know, it's a question of perspective. But while I was there, Erdogan, who's the current president of Turkey, unleashed a military operation against the PKK within Turkey. Okay, so there, now that's southeastern. I saw this on television. It was a big deal. It's sort of like, you know, if the U.S. sent in troops to, you know, to Washington State or something like that. And I'm in.
And there was an uprising.
There's armed issues going on there. And by the way, it's not necessarily. I met a lot of Kurds when I was there who are not necessarily supportive of PKK. I think if you're in that area, I think there is a lot of support in that area. The Kurds that moved to Istanbul or other places, it's not necessarily there. It's a real tricky thing. And one of the reasons it's tricky is that the Kurds, they have an electoral parliamentary system, and you need 10% to get into the game. The Kurdish party is hovering right around 10%. If Erdogan can keep the Kurds from getting 10%, he probably gets a majority in parliament. If he gets a majority in parliament, he passes a constitutional amendment that allows him to serve an additional term, which is unconstitutional, kind of like our provision, term limits. If the Kurds get in, he has to form a coalition government. So he marginalizes the Kurds and tries to keep them below. There's real heavy duty, very, very rough politics going on. If he demonizes the Kurds and the PKK in particular, then he thinks he can suppress the Kurdish vote.
And so we thought we had it bad here in the United States.
It's all very complicating. So the Kurds, by the way, you should also understand why they don't go after ISIS. Turkey is, except for the Kurds, almost 100% Sunni Muslim. ISIS is Sunni. Okay, and now Erdogan, the president of Turkey, despises the Syrian leader, who's Alawite too. So it's not like there's anybody he's terribly friendly with, but it's a very touchy thing for Turkey to go after a Sunni group like ISIS, no matter how outrageous they are. And he's publicly said that he's against them. He's allowed the American military to go in there and have use of Turkish bases. That's dicey to begin with. But I think politically, it's not a slam dunk for him.
It's tantamount to striking a bat at a hornet's nest.
Yeah, that's a fair analogy. So he hates Assad. He's wary about going after ISIS because they're fellow Sunnis. So they're extremists, but you know, that's one part of that. And then the other thing is what's going on in Syria. It's very clear to me that Assad is through in terms of ruling all of Syria. That's gone. But there's an enclave around Damascus that's heavily allied. Whether or not I think Syria is done as a country. It gets divided up. Whether or not Assad survives, you know, now he's got the Russians on their side. The Russians are in there saying they're bombing ISIS, but they're not really bombing ISIS. They're bombing some of the people that we are supporting, who are probably the least, or this so-called, you know, Democratic Resistance Front. It seems to be tiny, but they're the guys we're supporting. It's tough for us to find good guys in this hornet's nest. And those are the ones that the Russians have been bombing. So,
Have the human crisis of the Syrian refugees overflowing into the country. So it just seems like it's a complete morass out there.
You know, if you're Syrian, I saw an interview with somebody, a refugee, basically graduated from college. He said, and the next morning I'm out of there because the next thing that happens to me is I'm drafted into Assad's army and, you know, fighting for God knows what. So. Real mess. And I think my big takeaway on this is how incredibly complicated this gets presented very simply. Like, well, if I was president, said many candidates, you know, I'd just go in there and I'd bomb these bad guys.
It's not that straightforward, as you would know if you're living within the European Union and right next to it.
It is way complicated. That's the mess we got into in Iraq. We thought we were throwing out a bad guy. Well, it turns out, yes, he was a bad guy, but the other guys who came in weren't interested in setting up a pluralistic democracy. They're interested, and now it's our turn.
Well, we'll talk about the Syrian refugees and the latest on that front when we come back on The Think Tank right here on KTAR News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Welcome back to The Think Tank. I'm Holiday Moore in for Mike Russell, who has gone fishing. And our co-host and leader of the tribe here, Mike O'Neill, he's back from his intrepid journey to the Middle East, or what do we call that region? It's Turkey. It's right on the border.
I think it is the Middle East. It is certainly the bridge. Well, Constantinople, you know, is the only city in the world that sits between two continents. And that is, I think, both literally and figuratively true. It is a bridge between Europe and Asia.
And it literally is, when you walked into Turkey, you see the Western culture divided right in between this country with the Middle Eastern culture. Well, women in burqas, men in
not predominant.
Suits and ties.
Yeah, men in suits and ties or whatever. Western men. The dress of men was not particularly distinct, other than the semi-shaven beard. You know, what was pretty typical.
I found something really interesting, though, Mike, when you told me we were going to talk about this, and you were talking about Ataturk, who was given the credit in the early
in 1923,
who converted an entire country from a Muslim theology over to the Western civilization.
Well, let's not overstate. It is still. This is the interesting thing. It is, the feel is kind of a semi-Western country. It is still Muslim. How religious it is, I think, varies. I think very not unlike our own country in the sense that in the rural areas, very traditional and religious. In the urban areas, I saw a lot of signs of people who were sort of nominally religious. If you asked them, they'd probably say Muslim. But when the prayer things came out five times a day, they ignored it.
But what was so interesting is that you listen to this, you think that it is really an amalgamation of the Muslim and Western culture. But I was reading that Ataturk, as early as the mid-1930s, gave women more rights than we had right here in the United States. So they are in many ways far advanced in the cultures between men and women.
Ataturk set out to create a Western country. It was a Muslim country. It still is a Muslim country, but he's basically, if you want to see any country on earth that is truly Muslim and truly secular, it's Turkey. Now, there is a tension between those two. There are the religious folks who are not happy about that. They are the residual group that are not happy about Ataturk, who is revered as the father of his country. But if you went into the rural religious areas, my guess is he would not be a positive name. But he clearly, as I said, he outlawed the fez. Why? Because it's a symbolic thing. You know, it's a form of dress that set Turks apart from other Europeans. He was looking Western.
And he was educating. He was a proponent of education. So there's many ways that people look to him from the West as as the benchmark for that transition in that region.
Here's a guy who hasn't been in office for 85 years, but his fingerprints are all over everything. The current president, you can see Erdogan, who is a little rough and tumble, plays hard politics, but he is still playing off many of those tensions.
And he's playing in the Ataturk philosophy, or he's leaning more toward the Muslim philosophies?
I would say he's a pragmatic politician. I'd say he leans more Western. But for example, when technology came in and they invented loudspeakers, the mosque got the right to broadcast their prayers all over town. So that was clearly a concession. Now, their legal status, it's a secular country. You know, people are free, and most do ignore that. I went walking by mosques at the time of prayer, and you see these towers are blasting out the prayers. You look inside the mosque, and they're near empty. Now, I suspect that's not the case in the rural area. You have a big rural-urban division. Massive, massive structures. Some of the most impressive. And I tell you, one place in particular I went to in Istanbul was fascinating. Was originally a church, a Orthodox church, and then it became a mosque, and now it's a museum.
Interesting. And the Orthodox Church is really the big connection that has made the alliance with Russia. You were telling me earlier.
Well, that was Greek. That was Greece. There's a historian that I'm talking to, and he threw out, not as if he was making a statement, he threw out as a parenthetical. Well, of course, we Greeks have this natural affinity to Russia. And I'm just dumbfounded. And I pursued it with him. I said, wait a minute, Russia, aren't you a Western democracy, part of Europe and all that? And he pointed out to me the common thread was Orthodox religion. The Russian Orthodox Church is an offshoot of the Greek Orthodox Church. And he said, there's a kind of a cultural affinity there. Mm-hmm. And that to me, I pursued that matter with him. And one of the themes I think that I would, one of my takeaways, no country on earth likes it when they feel like other countries are pushing them around or telling them what to do. And we saw this in Greece in particular. Let me draw an analogy. You got a couple of friends, right? And one of them just comes in and says, this is what we ought to do, and you ought to, this is my idea, and you ought to just follow it. And the other one asks you what you think and accommodates a plan to your perspectives. And I think more often than not, the U.S. has been the former. You know, we know what's best for the world, and you just ought to follow. So we've decided that ISIS is the worst plague on the Middle East. And what's the matter with these other countries? Don't they get it how bad ISIS is? And by the way, I happen to think ISIS is a pretty awful group. But
it's not that easy.
It's, as I said, it's not that easy. And also they have other, if you're in Turkey, they're much more concerned about the PKK and Kurdish separation, which affects them much more deadly. And going after ISIS, which is a Sunni group, is touchy. You know, they have to be careful about how and under what circumstances. And I think where we've failed very often is not listening to where other, I mean, I think that was the big difference between the first and the second Gulf War. The first Gulf War really was a coalition. Everybody was in on it. That Saddam took over Kuwait, that was a bad thing. This will not stand was a widely accepted belief. The second time around, under George Bush the second, it was us and some people that we could strong arm. You know, the Poles, the Lithuanians, and other groups that basically were completely, we didn't have a buy-in by a whole lot of other people the second time around. And I think that's part of, you know, what that reminded me of. McNamara wrote a book after Vietnam, and it had 10 principles that he said we didn't, one of which I remember very vividly, said, you know, we're not that smart. If we want to do something and nobody else is in on it, maybe we ought to rethink where we're coming from because we're probably missing something.
Well, the people that lived in Syria and are moving their way over to Turkey, these are predominantly Muslim practicing people.
Yep.
They are finding themselves, the number now is well above 4 million.
Yep.
They're moving primarily through what countries? You were there, you were on the ground.
Okay, sure. The first place to go, if you look at the map, it's pretty simple. The first place you go is Turkey. because they have a very long contiguous border, and also it's the way west. And what happened was a couple of million ended up in Turkey, and Turkey is accommodating that. They've taken in a massive number, and then they just keep on coming and coming. And at some point, Turkey said, we're at overload here, and we're going to let them pass through to Greece and to other countries. And once, by the way, you cross that border from Turkey, which is not an EU country, it's NATO, but not EU. Once you cross from Turkey into Greece or some other Western country, but mostly Greece, you're in the EU, and then there's no internal borders. Now, they're trying to change that, or they're questioning that. But so all of a sudden, if you make it into Greece, then you're home free to go to Britain or France or Germany. And all of a sudden, those numbers start to go up. And all of a sudden, all those other countries in Europe get real interested. Wait a minute, they're on our doorstep right now.
And it's surprising where these people are going and who's taking them. The U.S. currently has a promise of 10,000. President Obama has said we promised to the EU that mm-hmm. we will take in 10,000. Canada has taken in far more than that. Mm-hmm. We have other countries that are throughout the EU that are taking in twice to 10 times more than that. We also hear that the number's been as high as 200,000. I don't know how trustworthy that number is, that being the U.S. taking in 200,000.
I haven't heard.
Well, that's
that
Donald anyway. Trump's yeah. comment almost 3 days ago. So where is the number?
I don't know where that number came. The big numbers that have changed are Germany in particular. And the interesting thing about that is their politics are not unlike ours in that Angela Merkel is taking a huge amount of flack over that. It could ultimately cost her job. So, wait and see on that one. Germany has been a pretty good citizen in Europe. I think they've.
Up next, we're going to talk about exactly who is playing to help out the Syrians. You'll be surprised who's taking in the Syrian refugees and who's not, right here on The Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Welcome back to The Think Tank. I'm Holiday Moore, in for Mike Russell. He's off fishing. And Mike O'Neill is back after his month-long journey to the Middle East, right there actually at the apex of the European nations and the Middle East.
Fascinating, fascinating part of the world. You see all this stuff we read about it, you kind of feel, as I said, I didn't feel danger at all, but I certainly felt that I was at the nexus of a whole lot of stuff that's coming on. Everybody there is very much aware of it because it's all very much in the neighborhood.
We were talking about the Syrian refugees, and right now there are over 4 million Syrian refugees, and that's actually a number that's considered underestimated, that are trying to get out of Syria or have fled Syria already. Many of those people are in Turkey. A great majority of them are there. Where else are they, and what were you learning while you were out there?
Biggest pieces are in, logically enough, are in adjacent countries. 2 million in Turkey, 1.5 to 2 million in Jordan, which is a huge stress. That's a tiny country, huge proportion of the population. 1 million in Lebanon. By the way, there's something else I just want to point out that I read about the origins of this. It ties into some other issues. There are some serious issues of climate change in that area. About half the rural areas are losing their water, and their farm areas and folks who are Sunnis. By the way, remember, Alawites run the country. That's 17%. The other 83% is mostly Sunni. They move from the rural areas into the cities. And they're very badly treated by the government. Some of the kids started protesting. They got jailed. They got tortured. And this was sort of the origin of the Assad was viewed as somebody who you don't mess. He basically is in total control. And 2 years ago, if you asked experts, what's the most unstable country? They'd say, Assad has total control. Well, the undermining of the economy of the country was a precipitating factor. These farmers move into the cities. They are not being well treated by the government. They start protesting. You start having an uprising. So I think that's the beginning of it. And it ties, I think, pretty clearly to some climate issues that basically have undermined the economy. Now the question is why anybody would want to stay there, because the country's a mess. And I think the country's over as a country with those boundaries. You look at, as I said, that you got the Alawites, 17% of the country. They're concentrated around Damascus and a few other little places. Other enclaves of other groups. We're searching real hard trying to find the good guys in this mess because it's not Assad. It's sure as heck not ISIS. You know, and what little remnants there were of something looked. By the way, we have horrible. You look at ISIS and they're driving around in American built Humvees. So that was the result of our last attempt to aid some group. So you think you're aiding one group and you don't know who's who. You know, you don't. They're not wearing uniforms over there that you can clearly identify. So.
There's no true allegiance once the troops are out of there.
Who's who? Yeah. Yep. You know, the rain seems to go from bad to worse.
Well, and you were talking about Jordan, which is really interesting mm-hmm. because this is a tiny little country that's outside of Syria and borders Syria. The people that are just overwhelming them, they're dealing with the fact that they are a tiny nation and they're having an infrastructure problem of their own. You're talking about climate problems. I mean, this is not just a matter of a bunch of people showing up on the streets. This is a matter of they don't have the support systems.
Turkey, let's see it in perspective, is a country of 75 million people. If they have 2 million immigrants that have come in, that's about 3% of the population. By the way, that's equal roughly to the number of illegal immigrants that we have in this country. However, we got ours over a 30 or 40 year period. They got them all in the last 12 months. So that's big. But if you go to a place like Jordan, those numbers are, as a percentage of the population, are orders of magnitude higher. And so they are literally bursting at the seams.
And they're unable to support the programs that they have there, are trying their best.
They're in camps, and there's international organizations that come in, but you're warehousing people in camps. It's an unsustainable situation. But when you're getting shot at, the first thing you do is get out.
Looking at the numbers, Mike, and these are numbers that are coming down from last month, so they're higher by now. We're seeing Germany, Angela Merkel is taking in a good fair share in the European Union. Mm-hmm. Turkey's taking in the brunt of everything,
yep.
It seems.
But and the other countries only got theirs when Turkey said, "All right, we're bursting at the seams. We're gonna give people free passage out of Turkey to wherever they want to go next."
And she said, "Okay, come on in." But now she's at a point.
I think she said, "We'll take." Okay, come on in. I'm not sure. She said, "We'll take some. We'll do our bit."
98,700 as of September. Yeah. So that's actually a lion's share in the European Union
compared to the other countries, not compared to Turkey.
Right in the European Union. Sweden, 64,000, almost mm-hmm. 65,000. France, 6,700. These numbers, again, are higher now because we are a good 2 weeks past these numbers. But the United Kingdom, 7,000. Denmark, 11,000. That's a tiny country that's mm-hmm. trying to help out. And in Hungary, it's 18,000. But when the refugees get there, it's not exactly helpful for them. I mean, they are being quarantined by police.
Yeah, that's not the degree of welcoming has varied by country, and Hungary's sort of at the bottom of the heap on that one.
The thing that I found was really strange is that the countries that sit right along the Gulf Coast, right there next to Syria, none are helping out.
And outrageous. These are Muslim countries, most of whom are sitting on boatloads of money.
Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain. Now, to the credit of the United Arab Emirates, they have taken in 250,000, and that's as of September. They're expecting to take more,
and that's a significant.
Helpful.
That's one of the smaller countries,
and that's actually ideal because the Syrians can actually assimilate. If there's ever peace in their region, they could actually continue and come back when peace returns, if that returns anytime soon. As you say, Syria is probably going to go the way of
most
the dodo.
Outrageous of the bunch, I think, is Saudi Arabia, which, by the way, committed $24 billion to build mosques in Europe. For refugees, zero. Outrageous.
Well, the U.S. is committed to 10,000, to helping out 10,000. Canada's 10,000, and they have already taken in somewhere over 2,700 refugees and have said in the next year, 10,000. So we're talking about that in 2016. You were there. You witnessed the sheer body flow. What was it like being there? Is it when your boots on the ground and looking around, how does it appear?
We didn't see large numbers. We're in the urbanized areas. For the most part, most of these folks are either blending in because they're trying to make their way out, in which case you don't see them. We saw a few people on the streets who said that they were Syrians. And you saw some panhandling, by the way, no more than you see here. Somebody pointed out that might have been a good shtick. You know, I'm Syrian, you know, get a little more sympathy. May or may not be true. I just don't know. But most of them are in Turkey or in camps, and they're not in that part of the country. They're near the Syrian border. And so in terms of actually seeing and feeling that directly, very little. It was in conversation.
Of the Syrian refugees that are coming here to the United States, Arizona is one of the states that's actually signed up to help with the intake. We've already taken in, over the history of the Syrian refugees coming in the past, somewhere over 100 people have relocated here, and we're known for being friendly to that. But we're one of a few states that do this.
You know, the reading I've done is that where you have success with those migration programs is where you have existing communities. In other words, if there is an existing Syrian community that speaks the language, and they take them in, those folks get jobs, and they do actually very well. If they have to go in, it makes a great deal of sense. If you go into a community in another country where you do not speak the language and there is no group there to welcome you and assimilate you, it's going to be way tough.
This is the month of October. We are, you know, this is when the United States declares how many refugees we're going to accept. The ceiling was set at 70,000. We've committed to 10,000. It's expected that we're gonna have quite a few more than that.
Well, and it's a moving number. That country is emptying out. Let me make some global points about this. You know, I'm not an expert in all this stuff. I feel like, you know, I've had a month there, and I figure I got to the third grade level of understanding of this. I do promise you that we will get in one or more experts here sometime in over the next few weeks to talk about and to question what I've told you. But my big takeaway, if somebody tells you, oh, this is just this simple, do this, you're wrong. I mean, that's true of all of our problems. If our problems were that simple, they would have already been solved. The only ones we're left with are the ones that are tough. You know, policy proposal, clean out 100 generals, hire 300 historians. We might be more secure nationally. We need to understand the other countries better.
And that's the final word, at least for now, from Mike O'Neill and all of us here at KTAR News. I'm Holiday Moore, sitting in for Mike Russell on The Think Tank. KTAR News.